No, so I really do hope we do need as a society a way to begin looking at these issues. And I think if there's any awakening that should come out of the September 11th event, it should be around the need for us to go beyond just the government is going around the country right now in the name of Homeland Security, asking physicists and chemists and computer scientists and others to congregate and give their opinions on things. We really need to be dealing with not the high technology areas, but some of these really important political, economic, moral, religious components, because we're getting to be a society where we're going to have our own religious war. I mean, that's what the religious right is all about in some way.
About the September 11th thing is that it can serve to close off dialogue. You know, be in the essence of the paranoid kind of feeling and patriotism and closing off. Because I think that you brought up the issue of who would decide. Would the Tesla Society decide what is moral? Who would decide what is moral in a global culture? And I think that the answer to that would be to open up the dialogue, to open it up as wide as you can, because I think that Jung had the whole concept of the shadow, mm-hmm. the psychological structure mm-hmm. of the shadow, and what is the best way of dealing with the shadow, shine a light on it. Mm-hmm. And with open dialogue, you have to, that's lovely, I'm so glad to have been exposed to the Japanese mm-hmm. teachings that you have there. As part of, I think, the mix of San Francisco and the mix of some of our large cities now, and the blending of cultures is that you do have this wide range. And opening the dialogue up to as many people as possible to talk about these issues, I think would be the way to deal with who comes up with what is going to be the moral choice.
I certainly agree with that. And I guess I would also go further and say it was like the last stage in that second of the Japanese, where you go back and you teach. I believe that education is going to be fundamental to this whole process, that we really do need to find a way to integrate this into the educational, I can't even think of a word, but the core of ourselves, because education is at the core, either in parenting or in being friends or being community, whichever words you want to use, there has to be some driving educational component that makes it possible again to propagate the it's the cycle vaccine.
Is
there,
I think to some degree this is happening with, you know, I know there was an active effort to build concepts like trying to teach cooperation in Sesame Street and other projects of the Children's Television Workshop, which have been widely received and widely watched. When you watch some of the programs, there's a lot of themes going constantly through the show about kids cooperating or different characters cooperating with each other to get something done that they couldn't normally do themselves or by kind of competing against each other.
That was the Bank Street programs, I think, the Bank Street School of Education in New York City was the major player behind that, so both Sesame Street and as well as the connection with the guy who did the, who died.
Mr. Fred
Rogers?
Or
no.
Jim Henson. Along those lines, on the other side of the scale, a lot of kids get their education from television, and a lot of what they see, well, a lot of it getting at a young age, is this constant bombardment of bias and of these families. And I'm wondering if, you know, part of the reason that people are not as interested, are not following the democratic process as much, or following politics, or being aware of the worldview, is because they've been so saturated with this at an earlier age that's where their motivation is to accumulate. And it isn't a caring attitude of looking at the world, saying, where am I and how do I fit into this and what can I do and what's important in the world?
I'm actually concerned about that at several levels. Television is enormously violent. In fact, I don't look at it for precisely that reason. Television doesn't allow kids to distinguish between truth and reality. I'm now living in Long Beach, and one of the things I'm struck by is how people's minds are television and film minds. You ask them about a scene in a movie or a quote, and they can give you the actor and the particular movements, and they just have this incredible memory for fiction. In fact, I jokingly said to someone, what we really need is a browser which does browsing for scenes in film rather than browsing for words. It's very difficult to find people who distinguish between truth and reality down there. Recently you had the Harry Potter book put to film. The Harry Potter book is these are books that kids like and they read over and over and over. The film is not like the, and there's some components that are like it, but there's a richness in the Harry Potter books that's not captured in the film, as was with the Lord of the Rings film. And the people just don't really get it. They don't appreciate it. We also have the explosion of the internet and the World Wide Web, which again is globalizing, the globalization of information. And if you have people buying into all these urban legends and different statements that we have. So we do need education, but we need a form of education in conjunction with media that has a certain, I don't want censorship. I would not want censorship, but I would want a sense of honesty and decency and fairness about the underlying information that would not allow things to get out of hand. I mean, if we're going to talk about Islam, we don't need to say it's us versus them or they're evil or presenting the information in a way that it's going to have some longer term negative consequences. So I think we have a struggle in how to deal with the presentation of information as a component of education that is going to present some real challenges.
I have a couple of ideas in terms of psycho vaccines. One of them would be what I would loosely call the uncommercial, just more little 30-second messages about the wonder of being alive that people heard on a daily basis to help counter this on a daily basis, because it's constantly drilled into people on a subconscious level even. And the other idea is that I would like to see them build a couple of skyscrapers on the side of the World Trade Centers. But in those skyscrapers, I would put one floor for every country in the world, which would be a showcase for the best of their art, their language, their culture, their food, and people could travel from all over the world to get and their religions and their spirituality, and to take in the whole world in these two skyscrapers.
Sort of a World Trade Center. So
yeah, right. The World Center would have the trade.
And where would the U.S. be? Would it be at the top, or would it be in the middle, or would it be at the bottom? I don't think that's a bad idea. It is not a bad idea, and it's not a bad idea for another reason. The economics of the World Trade Center was such that, you know, the higher you went up, the more expensive the real estate was. And that's the way people in New York were dealing with real estate, even the Empire State Building, same way. So if you have this as a memorial, where...
It's kind of a United Nations for the people themselves to be to participate in, to experience firsthand, rather than something that, you know, walk from the distance of the United Nations. Having security meetings and so forth.
Yeah, the 170-something nations that easily could take a very tall structure, and as you say, each floor would be a nation where the same amount of square footage each floor, so that each person is equal, each nation is equal in that sense. I think it's a really excellent idea, and I will mention it to several people. We'll give them a floor, and they can have what they want.
But they're against depiction.
No,
they were Buddhists, but they destroyed Buddhists.
Yeah. But I mean, the Taliban had a completely blank floor.
That's right.
Towards the rest of the world. It just may not be the best path. And that's how the question actually works.
But they might want to blow up everybody else's. Which reminds me of this Yusuf Rashid, the one who did the planning for the first World Trade Center bombing, and when he was taken into custody, he said they would be back, you know. And his idea was to blow up the building so that it crashed into the
second building,
and it brought down buildings all around it. And his goal was for 250,000 people to be killed by it, because there would be no time to evacuate at all. So, you know, when you think of the possibilities in the head of these people to have devastating damage, and that was on the to-do list, just like our Capitol and White House are still on the to-do list.
Yeah. And they probably still are on the to-do list.
Yes, that's what I mean. They're still on the to-do list.
Do you have any other ideas yourself in terms of cycle vaccines that could be helpful? Even when you get people like Osama bin Laden, there's always followers, just another generation to come up. How do you inoculate them?
I don't know, but I had always been committed to education being at the core of it, of cycle vaccines. That was actually the reason that I proposed teaching medicine in the elementary and secondary schools, that's to vaccinate against the professions and poverty and other kinds of things. I always want people to leave knowing that I don't know everything. I wish I did. I have ideas about everything. You know, if you come to any of my talks, you know that I've always got something new to say. Just as you've heard today, and I have been just describing breakthrough science. I'm saying this to say that when I introduced psychoviruses, I did introduce the notion of psychovaccines. I did have in mind that education would be at the core, but I did not have a sense of how education may itself be limiting. And what I'm being forced to think about as we're talking here today is novel, and I don't even call them novel, but ways of education that go beyond the tradition. And that's what's so exciting about your idea about the new World Center, because it allows for not only each nation to present itself as it wishes, it allows for different models of information for education, for what have you. I have no doubt that America would want it for to show capitalism and its sense of market economy and stuff. But for the first time to have a different scheme of values reflected, where everyone really wants to go from floor to floor to floor to see how these developments would occur. I think that might be the ultimate cooperative, competitive model that was in that first slide that I showed, where together they push the boulder out of the way, where the boulder are the obstacles to education, and they all cross the finish line at the same time. But again, I'm limited by my own cultural, educational heritage, and as I said, the Tesla Society always makes it possible to think of new things. I remember our friend Marty Milton, who's a co-founder of the Elder Hospital Organization, and he always thought that we should use the Treasure Island out here as the West Coast equivalent of Ellis Island, and put up a peace monument out here.
I know that Viktor Frankl, when he wrote Man's Search for Meaning, he's a Holocaust survivor and founder of the Third Viennese School of Psychology or Psychotherapy and Logotherapy. He thought that he wanted to see, just as the East Coast had a Statue of Liberty, it's a symbol of freedom, the West Coast should have a statue of responsibility.
And that's what his responsibility was the that's what Martin Olten proposed. In fact, it was some woman from Santa Cruz or Carmel that first put the idea forth. And I can probably dig out the paper that they wrote on this. But I think it is a really marvelous idea. And I had been, until today, I had not been willing to see the World Trade Center be rebuilt at a height, mainly because I think we place too much value on height. But I think that the way that you proposed it, because of the space limitations and whatnot, could be done. Of course, it's going to be a target for other attacks in the future. But I think we need to consider what we can design to get around those attacks. And I must add that if we respond to the cause, let's assume that there was a provocation that led to this act at the World Trade Center. If we deal with the underlying provocation, that in and of itself will be a marvelous feat, at least from my viewpoint.
I think that's probably a good place to end. Thank you for your wonderful presentation. It is 4:30.
Do
you want to keep going?
I'm always willing to talk and listen.
Are you familiar with any of the things that are available for schools from the Southern Poverty Law Center? They have a series called Teaching College that years of different grade levels that's available for each of the schools.
I'm not really on top of it. In fact, I really look to see if I can find some of that. I know the California Department of Mental Health used to put out a series called Friends to Be Good Medicine, which is now abandoned. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking concretely about law and society. But I do think that at the core, we really need to deal with friendship,
getting people to engender friendships with people that they would not likely do. That's part of what my birthday bash was all about, to bring, I'm the center. I had been friends to all these different people, and I said, let's come together and see what happens. What happens when they mix with each other.
And that is, these various organisms that are able to transfer their resistance to antibiotics to other types of organisms, do you understand how that is going on? I mean, it's not just
to their
offspring
own stuff, right.
Of their own type, they are actually transferring this resistance to...
part of that has to do with the nature of synergy. For example, let's suppose we're dealing with E. coli, which populates the gut. If we take a drug and we feed it and it gets to the gut and it causes the change in antibody resistance, the bacteria release that information, both the drug as well as the modified toxins of whatever comes out of it, and it goes through something called the M cell system in the gut, and then the M cell system modifies its immunity in ways that we're only now beginning to understand. But work on M cells is done here at UCSF, following Robert Owen. And that's one way this is being done. But I don't know too many people who are looking at that, the transfer of resistance and the transfer of tolerance in a way. That's part of what his question is about in terms of the organ transferring tolerance. So it would be related. And there's one other person who, her name is Toby or Tony Rodman. She's in New York. And she's looking at how, I think it's, I've seen so many papers in the last couple of months, but she's looking at what happens when you vaccinate in utero. You introduce something in utero before the child is born. The child develops a tolerance in ways that they might not have developed otherwise. So it's not transfer of immunity, but it is effectively to vaccinate early on. And I have a file on it that I just created in the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I'll see if I can pull together some of it.
Is that what's going on when they do this treatment of AIDS?
What they're doing with the treatment of AIDS, they're just before the child is born, they introduce the heart, the three drug combination, and what they're finding is that knocks out, for reasons we don't understand, because it doesn't eliminate the virus, but for some reason it knocks out the child's or the child develops no HIV, and we don't know whether the reaction is because of the mother or because of the child. But the child comes out when it's born with no exposure to HIV and, from the evidence, no long-term care status of HIV. Almost with every story associated with HIV, though, I would add the caveat that what we know now may not be what we know 5 years from now. There are so many things that are changing. This looks like it's a boom, but it may not be. Another study that just comes out, a woman named Chandice Covington, she's looking at grandmothers in Africa. She's noted that she's come at this from a breast cancer point of view. She noticed that women in Africa have a low incidence of breast cancer, and she or someone identified that they're what she called plugs of wax that women have. When they don't have kids, these plugs develop, and when they're constantly having kids, the plugs are not there. Now, what she did was two things. She developed a way of aspirating not breast milk per se, or maybe a small quantity of breast milk. These are grandmothers. These are after their nursing period. But she's finding a way of aspirating this liquid material, which has immunoglobulins, and they're transferring that to the children. So this is a way of using what is in breast milk in the first place, which is immunoglobulins, to help do that. I'm going to be meeting her on the 4th or 5th of February, and what is exciting is not only this wax. You know, some people have wet air wax and some have dry air wax. I'm interested in whether the wax in this breast plugs are wet and dry, and whether they correlate with the, you know, with the constituency of whether there's a commonality to the kinds of wax.
Written called Personality in Our Genes. Now, they're struggling desperately to remember the author, because I actually met the author 2 years ago in Berkeley, and he's been sort of on the lecture circuit during there, but he's probably the most prolific or talkative person that talk about how genetics and personality traits and psychology sort of mixed together. And I'm struggling to remember the name of the author. I'm sorry, I can't. The name of the book is called The Personality in Our Genes.
I'll have to see if I can find it. You know, someone wrote me a note hinting at something about the meme stuff. When I introduced my notion of psychoviruses, I actually had thought about that Richard Dawkins stuff. But there was something that didn't quite meet the criteria that I wanted to distinguish between cultural, genetic, and infectious components, and that's why I had to introduce the notion of.
The concept of memes is taken on a very biological systems model perspective, but there's also predatory memes as well as there are memes that are intended for, you know, sort of positive outcomes. So they had a broader range, right? I think in your world, you're going to be focusing very specifically on the proactive aspect of using the vaccine to improve behavior and improve our reflexion.
But I'll have to look for this personality.
In fact, I think I had your card from last time we met. I'll email you the floor if I can.
Well, you can call it again.
I do have, since there's so few people here, I do have copies of several things that I'm willing to share with you. I thought if there were only 30 or 40, 50 people, I just wouldn't have them. What I have, there were three or four references at the end of the announcement for the talk that I am giving today, and I have three, I think, of those papers. I couldn't find a fourth one. One of them is a manuscript for a book-length publication. This was done in 1980s, 86, 87. So I haven't really gone back and modified it since then, if you want a copy of it. I started to write a book. I sent a proposal into the Simon Guggenheim Foundation, and I had hoped it they would fund it, but they didn't. I have copies of these. Two pictures.
Have you given any thought to this idea of the militarization of space that we seem to be heading towards?
I've thought about it, but I haven't thought about it in quite what I've been hoping is that we would realize that that's a waste of time, because it's just going to lead to another phenomenal out of control war situation, and that's why I think that the Condi Rice Colin Powell policy. These I don't think I have enough copies of. I don't think that they are reflecting on how their little selfish actions, selfish in the sense of wanting to be in the government and in the political administration, is going to have a long-term consequences for the race, if I can call it that. I really don't have enough. I only have three of these. One of them is summarized in that big paper, and then the other one does. It just introduces the notion of psychoanalysis, but it's basically what I said there. The one I've just given you captures everything that's in all these other papers, and it's unfortunately an outline form, but it contains all the references, and you'll see that I took this very, very seriously when I started thinking about it back in the 80s. And it took Osama bin Laden or whomever to sort of get me to start reflecting on it again. But it was done in a way now that it has helped me bring the whole picture together completely. So in that sense, I'm really excited about it. So, if there are any other questions?
Speaking of society and the margins and with your biological medicine like lens, you mentioned that news article we saw in the Rancher about the mother being killed by the son.
Yes.
We're seeing a lot of this kind of similar violence. I would say more extreme type violence. And we saw it just in the past few years more the school shooting, and then now we're seeing these more kind of almost on a more personal level murders and whatnot. What is it? And then finally, just the guys who exposed to the issues. What are you saying about, people like D.H. Lawrence and all this, they took society at a psychological level and pronounced it schizophrenic or at least unhealthy. What is it saying? Have we progressed into some kind of a suicidal thing for our race now? Or these incidents would mean something, but some change has taken place.
Well, I have no doubt that these incidents would have meaning. There is no question in my mind about that. All you have to do is look at the people who are destroying their lives, whose lives are being taken in Palestine, and the people who flew the planes into the World Trade Center. There's some hero. Mortar status that's at play, and the question I see you asking is, what is the nature of the rage that's there that lead to a person taking their own life, which is the same rage that a person would go to war with, Desert Storm or Afghanistan. And it's the same rage that would allow our president to say, we won't put our guys down on the ground because we don't want the American mothers to be concerned about the loss of their kids. We'd rather have the Afghanistanis fight our war. I find that unconscionable. That we'll do all the bombing and we'll let your guys get shot up and killed and all these other things, but we wouldn't let our own people do that. And that's the thing, I want people to go to war. I'm saying that when you force people to say they're going to allow their own lives to be sacrificed rather than making someone else a part of the shell game, there's something I find reprehensible about that. But your point about what is going on that that has these people, mostly men, committing these terrorist actions. Why not women, for that matter? Americans made a big deal about the burqa and stuff, but I think the bigger issue is why are the people who are committing these acts men? And what is it about this more to them? I mean, we're being told that it's more to them, but in fact, it could be. It was just enraged, people being just totally enraged about the way they feel about the things we do that's led to this. Jim Jones, for all the people here in San Francisco, got people to do. Commit mass suicide, and what is it about that? Or the Enrico person? I don't.
Well, there is this kind of virus out there that they all believe that they're going to a better place when they die, when they do this. And I've often, there's this program on right now with John Edwards, and supposedly he talks to people beyond. On the other side after they've died, and he talks back to their family. I don't know how much truth there is in it, but if there is truth in it, it would be interesting if he were able to pull in some of these Taliban leaders or so forth and had other people from the other side tell them, look, this is what really happened to me after I blew up the World Trade Center. that's an odd and unusual way of shedding light on the shadow, but this psychovirus, as you would say, has been used, it's been active, and also used to get to motivate people to do things that they normally would never do. And it's a psychovirus that goes back thousands of years. It's been used by leaders for...
Craig Haney, who was Zimbardo in the original Stanford Prison Experiment, where they randomly assigned students to either be prisoners or guards. In social psychology, they've shown the Jim Jones phenomena, where if you can get people to acquiesce to small things at first, then it gets bigger and bigger, and you control their universe, basically. So, and they, Jim Jones took all these people and he isolated them. Now, they didn't all take the Kool-Aid willingly. Some of them just went and acquiesced. A lot of them were forced to. But I think that you have to, when you're looking at this whole bit, thing, it's so interesting. When you get down to the molecular level, I'd like to see what's happening, because there are ways to get people to acquiesce to things just simply by talking to them. And you can get people to say the most outrageous things. I was thinking like candid camera. I mean, it's like, you can just get people to do things unthinkingly. I think that the more education, I think, is really a key that Robert was saying, that if you can get people to be thinking beings, because they really are social animals, but we're also thinking beings, and to think about things, to think things through, just
critical thinking,
exactly.
Which is not taught
really
to school.
No,
you're taught to memorize and go through some incredibly mundane rote kind of exercises without anything to do with thinking or critical analysis at all.
What we'll have to do as a society is to accept what comes from that, because when our kids start talking back at us with ideas that we're kind of entrenched, we have to open ourselves up too. But I think that as a society, we have not been willing to allow that kind of discourse among young people who might have ideas that are very different from ours, to allow that kind of dialogue. And I think that dialogue would be very critical.
And that would become a new culture. That truly would, because we're all conditioned into the cultures that have those routinized ways of doing.
Right, that would be a new culture.
Good. Diversity is the key to the health of any ecological system. I don't care if it's anthropological system, sociological, or a natural biophysical system. The more diverse, the higher the health index. It sort of works quite linear that way. So diversity and cultural training, you might call it, I think would be absolutely the mission critical pathway to better evolutionary change. One thing I'll blurt out is that these killings of these kids who have been shooting up the schools and shooting their parents, just as a side note, the majority of them, it turns out, have been on these various psychotropic drugs. Xanax, and a whole bunch of others. And that's kind of interesting, because that's actually an artifact of failure of parents, community, et cetera. So they've just been throwing pills at these kids, and then the kids go into the horrible psychosis, and then eventually they go out and shoot people and cause crazy things. In other words, would these kids have done things quite that outrageous had they not been pushed into this arena because of the drugs that were propelled?
I had known that those kids were on those drugs, because remember the woman who's now being tried in Texas, who killed the kids, was taken off a drug that could help her. But it raises the bigger issue of the interaction between drug and mind. I mean, Kim Kesey sort of, he makes the point that the asset that they got from the government was so much, so great, so pure, that the experiences that they had at the time were just out of this world in some way, and just pure. And as we stop and we reflect on all kinds of psychoactive drugs, whether it be Ritalin or whether it be Prozac or Xanax or any of the others, we really do need to to ask the question, what's going to be the profile of changes in brain, and can we say something about whether they would be prudent or imprudent? Because one of the messages I didn't make clear to you today, I did say it, but this technology that I'm hoping to introduce essentially says that the changes in brain are not with any clear biochemical markers that you'll be able to check a blood level for titration or whatnot. So we really will need a technology that we can measure the effects of a relatively non-specific drug on a rather specific aspect of brain, because these drugs are not being targeted for a specific axonal dendritic connection. They're being targeted for the whole of brain, and maybe, possibly, we'll find ways to target things to very specific sub-regions in the long-term future.
Kind of relates to, this was a question I was going to ask earlier, but I'm glad you brought it, Charles. It's basically, you know, are these psychoactive or psychotropic drugs changing the DNA? Is this being passed on? Is something like LSD, does that change the DNA?
Is
people passing it on?
It has not escaped my attention that one of the types of studies that will have to be done once I show the demonstration, demonstrate changes, will be to see what will be the effects of LSD and some of the other psychoactive, XD and some of the others. Because we know that they change ideation. We know that ideation changes experience. So is there some clear, circumscribed way that those ideas, the ideation is changing so that we can, in fact, make some clear predictions? That would be, I won't say revolutionary, but it would certainly bring to a kind of a logical conclusion what Leary and what was the other guy, Timothy Leary and Alpert started doing when they were at Harvard, and the CIA for that matter. There's a film that some of you may have seen, Beautiful Mind, it's called, about John Nash, and you thought it was not well done?
No, I thought it was well done as it could be, given such a matter.
Yeah. But my point is that the notion of the schizophrenia, regardless of Nash himself, it captures what schizophrenia may, there may be changes between one half and the other half of the brain. There could be multiple personality implications, to the extent that multiple personalities are different from schizophrenia. There are a whole range of possibilities that will, I believe, fall out of this new model. Again, my contribution must be to demonstrate the changes, and then I'll just leave it to younger people like yourselves to do bigger and better things with it.
Could I ask, sir, for the reference for our conversation, if the questions we are raising now about psychotropic drugs for children, if that kind of questioning in light of your ideas could also be applied to other medical manipulations that are more routine, like vaccination, which may, even though there are negativities that have been with us perhaps for as long as humans have existed, it seems that there are also some that are novel or new to this past century, and perhaps some medical intrusions are among causative factors and that have not been examined, and maybe not even necessary to look at it at a molecular level. Harris Coulter suggests structural changes at the neuroimmune and endocrine level that create a difference in moral perception if there's a physiology to moral development.
There are enough examples to make your point. Anthrax vaccine, remember the people, the military guys are not wanting it, and in fact the people at the post office refused the anthrax vaccine. So there's the intersection between the medical and the sociological, psychological. The MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, people think that there's a connection with autism. The evidence is not there, but the model allows us to answer that kind of question. Excuse me. The flu vaccines have been associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome. This is where you have a progressive paralysis up to the neck and then it finally goes away. We may be able to see some changes there, where the changes I would speculate would be in the cerebellum. And the question is are the changes permanent? Or if the changes are permanent, what is the mechanism that compensates and restores the system? So there are many opportunities for new models to come out of this. Again, the first stage is to demonstrate the change.
It seems for its own sake, of course, is pursued just by virtue of the patent process in medicine. There is a remedy to offset the negative side effects of vaccines. It's in homeopathy and it's Fuja, and I've benefited from it enormously myself. But it's known. You know, it's not something that research is, another lifetime of research is required. But there are other solutions, perhaps, that should be used, you know, that aren't already at hand.
And I just learned also that there's a homeopathic remedy for anthrax, no side effects. Someone I know has just written a paper on that.
Well, this has been really exciting for me. I knew that
I would have a good time when I came. All I can say is thank you.
Thank you.